Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media and Free Speech Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, January 19, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll be discussing social media content control. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Thomas C. Arthur, LQC Lamar Professor of Law at the Emory University School of Law, and Professor Eric Goldman, Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law and Co-Director at the High Tech Law Institute. After opening remarks from Professor Arthur, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Okay. Well, welcome, everybody, and thanks for calling in and listening to us. This program was initiated by several lawsuits, which are indications of a perceived censorship by social media sources like Google and Facebook against people on the groups on the right. We don't really know whether this is actually a widespread a function or not. That's an empirical question, and all we have about it is anecdotes. But there is a perception by speakers on the right that these groups are in some ways impeding their ability to reach the audience. I think it's important to put this in perspective as to exactly what we're talking about. The complaint does not seem to be that they can't have access to the internet. That doesn't seem to be the case. What they're saying, though, is that they are being impeded or burdened in reaching the high volume, the high audience groups, things like Facebook, like Twitter, like YouTube, where there's a big audience to be achieved. And there are three lawsuits that we've seen recently which suggest that. First of all, there was a suit filed, I believe, last August or September. Gab, which is a sort of a version of Twitter that says it's more open to all speakers and particularly conservative speakers than other groups like Twitter, filed a lawsuit against Google saying that complaining that Google had not accepted its application for its app to be on the Google Play Store, which would be the app source for a lot of telephones, Android telephones. That case ultimately got settled, but they made an antitrust claim saying that Google, through its contractual relationship with Twitter, was trying to suppress their alternative, their competing site. But their real complaint seemed to be that, well, this was being done because we're on the right side of the political spectrum and you don't like us. The second case was Prager University, or PragerU as it's sometimes called, against Google and YouTube. And PragerU was complaining that Google's unit, YouTube, which Google owns, was putting on its age-restrictive monitoring system or filtering system for people under 18 and having this so-called restricted mode that cut off many of its so-called, its instructional videos, its educational videos. And the thought was not that these were really unsuitable for people under 18, but because there was an objection to their ideological point of view. The third case was, I believe, Chump Johnson versus Twitter. And Twitter actually finally banned Mr. Johnson from their site. He claims because his views were too far to the right. There's some evidence in the case, and Professor Goldman knows more about this than I do. But I believe, Eric, wasn't it that ultimately they just got tired of him trolling on their site? But anyway, he actually got banned from the site. So, as I say, there are these cases which indicate a perception that there might be some moderation, some filtering that's ideologically oriented. Now, at the same time, there is a lot of pressure on sites like Facebook and Google to do more monitoring and editing, as it were, of their content. Facebook was called before a committee of the House of Representatives last fall, I believe it was, where they were put under intense pressure to filter their news to make sure that they weren't purveying what the congresspeople thought was fake news. And indeed, Facebook has made an alteration in its news feed recently. Internationally, in Germany, the Wall Street Journal and The Economist have both reported that German law requires Facebook to ensure that hate messages, hate speech messages, are not on Facebook. And they, according to the Wall Street Journal, a disproportionate number of its monitors of Facebook are dedicated to sort of censoring, as it were, the German Facebook pages. So there's at least a big issue, and an issue worthy of discussion, and it's not really limited to conservative groups. It should be, at least theoretically, for any unpopular speaker on the left or the right or otherwise, whether there is, A, as an empirical matter, that they are being restricted or burdened as reaching audiences on high audience sites like YouTube, like Google, like Facebook, and if so, whether the law does or should do anything about that. Now, assuming that there is some of this, or that there might be some of this in the future, at least in the United States law, is there a legal remedy? And I'm not going to, let me just mention this at the beginning of my discussion of possible remedies. Section 230, as it's popular known, 47 U.S.C. 230, commonly but not accurately reported as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, provides a pretty strong legal immunity for sites like Google and Facebook to, in effect, edit or moderate their sites. And that, Eric is going to talk about in some detail as we go on in this program, but I just want you to keep it in mind as I discuss quickly the two main theories that have come up in these lawsuits. The first one, and this is in the Gab case, is an antitrust claim. And frankly, antitrust claims aren't likely to be an important part of this discussion, so I don't want to spend a lot of time with them, but I do feel like I need to tell you why, since the Gab case was all based upon a Sherman Act claim. The reason the antitrust claim is limited is for several reasons, I should say. The first reason is the plaintiff must be a competitor of the defendant for this to even begin. So in the Gab case, Gab had to say, well, we were being discriminated against so that Twitter could have an anti-competitive advantage over Gab, and we're both competitors. Secondly, even if there are competitors, the next thing is the defendant must be a monopoly. And there's a lot of loose talk now about sites like YouTube and Google and Facebook being monopolies, but that is not as obvious as some of the media suggest. Now, if you've looked at today's Wall Street Journal, you'll see there's a giant article about the so-called antitrust claim against these big media companies, and the cover story in the upcoming Economist is also going to be on that. But journalists are not judges, and I think it's useful to keep that in mind. Whether there really is a monopoly here depends on some complicated economic and legal issues about what the real market is, who really competes with whom, and especially is not just do companies have a large usage, but is there something that keeps people from entering that market and competing with them, what the economists call barriers to entry. And that's not so obvious. I mean, to give a concrete example of that, in the Gab case, there was nothing that kept Gab from competing with Twitter. And they had their site out there. So they presumably could compete. Even beyond that, if there is a monopoly, is this covered by the Sherman Act to favor one of your sources, or to give an affiliate or yourself a competitive advantage if it's not actually trying to create a new monopoly in that area? And the law on that is a bit unclear. There are some cases that say that a monopolist who uses his monopoly to get a competitive advantage, even if he's not monopolizing in a second area, would be liable, but there are also cases that suggest that that's not the law, and particularly the Trinco case from 2004 suggests that this is not likely to be a winner. So the antitrust theories are difficult to make and probably aren't going to apply in a lot of cases. And if you remember, I mentioned Section 230. And Eric, I want to ask you to chime in here, because if I'm correct, Section 230 could also trump an antitrust claim in this area anyway.
Let me just mention a few words about Section 230, and then I think you're going to finish your thoughts, and I'll perhaps add some others. Section 230 was passed in 1996, and the way I summarize it in lay speak is that websites aren't liable for third-party content. There are three statutory exceptions, none of which I think will be relevant to our discussion today. So the general premise is that if there's liability for online content, that liability rests with the person who originates the content, but not a republisher or anyone else who might be affiliated with republishers. And that rule has been applied very broadly across a wide range of circumstances. So it doesn't really matter how the claim is framed. If the ultimate objective is to hold a website liable for third-party content, then Section 230 protects it. There's a lesser-known provision in Section 230 that goes even further to say that websites aren't liable for their filtering decisions. Now, there's some additional qualifications to that, but the idea was very clear behind Section 230. If a site publishes content, it's not liable for third-party content. If it removes third-party content, it's not liable for that removal decision either. And so it really eliminates a lot of the legal theories that normally plaintiffs like to marshal up to try and hold somebody accountable for someone else's words. We do have some cases that have applied Section 230 against antitrust claims. In fact, a case that came out just recently this year, one of the allegations against the defendant was a Sherman Act claim, and it just got swept up in the overall discussion about Section 230. The court didn't have anything special to say about the antitrust considerations. It simply said, I see, plaintiff, that you are trying to hold the site accountable for third-party content. I don't care if you call it an antitrust. I don't care if you call it some tort theory. You lose.
Yeah, and that's pretty definitive. So let's switch from antitrust to the more interesting area, which was raised by the PragerU case and the Chump Johnson case, which are claims that in some ways these big sites like Facebook, YouTube, Google are the functional equivalent of the town square, or what in First Amendment terms has been called the traditional public forum. And there's some loose talk, quite honestly, that companies like Google have engaged in, particularly in earlier years, that, well, we're just here to provide a way for people to communicate and get to each other and reach the web, and we don't really edit. It's not up, you know, it's not up to us to decide what the content is. There's not as much of that talk anymore, but these theories tend to be cases that have one or two different theories. The first theory would be that, well, you've created this sort of public or virtual town square, if I could call it that, and therefore you should be subject to the same kind of restrictions that the First Amendment places on the government and particularly local governments for their town squares, for their actual town squares, where they're not allowed to engage in viewpoint restriction of who can say hold rallies and street parades and otherwise speak in the town square. The only actual case they have that's somewhat like that is a case from 1947 called Marsh against Alabama, where there was a so-called company town where it was private property, but it was the functional equivalent for the people who worked for that company as a town and had a square. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Black, said that they would be treated as if they were the government. There really hasn't been anything quite like that since then. The closest thing I can think of is a case from 1979 called Prune Yard Shopping Center, in which the California courts held that a shopping center, which was open to the public under the California Constitution, was required to permit a couple of students, high school students, I believe they were, to put up a little card table in the mall and argue about questions about the Arab boycott and things like that of Israel. And this pro-Israeli Israel spot wasn't particularly objected to by the owner of the shopping center, but the shopping center just didn't want to have political activity in his shopping center. He didn't say this interfered with his speech. It just was something he didn't want to have to deal with. And the California Supreme Court said, well, under the California Constitution, you have to permit this. And in an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed, saying that, well, this didn't violate the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The shopping center had argued that this provision of the California courts would actually violate its First Amendment rights, claiming that it was for being compelled to speak. And there is a long line of cases saying that people can't be compelled to speech, as the famous flag salute case, West Virginia Board of Education against Barnett from the 40s. There is the famous Live Free or Die license plate case, Woolley against Maynard, from a later time, that said that you can't be required to express a message that isn't yours. But in this case, the shopping center owner, according to the court, didn't have a message one way or the other, and therefore it was distinguishable. That's about the best you can come up with for this kind of theory. Now, there's a history in this, and I think it might be useful to tell you what it is. There were a couple of professors, and I knew one of them, Jerome Barron, who in the 60s and 70s was the dean of George Washington Law School, and he had a buddy named Thomas Deans at American U Law School, and they together wrote The Nutshell on First Amendment. And their theory was that media, particularly the print media, had become so concentrated with only one newspaper in modern times in a city, that this was as concentrated as and hard to reach the public as the television lanes were. And they argued that just as the Supreme Court had allowed the FCC in the Red Lion case to regulate broadcast stations and require them to provide equal time to speakers, that newspapers could be required to do the same thing. And Florida passed a statute on this theory. But in the famous Miami case versus Torrijos case of 1974, the Supreme Court pretty much said virtually that, well, Professor Barron's theory is very nice about we need to have affirmative support for speakers. We just can't do that because editing newspapers is the job of newspaper editors, and the First Amendment absolutely protects it. So there really hasn't been a lot of support for this kind of idea that you can compel people to let you speak on their platform. So when we get down to talking about these cases now, the argument is, are sites like Google and Facebook and YouTube, are they more like newspapers or more like this open shopping center or, say, cable TV systems or the broadcast media? And the court has said pretty emphatically in the, was it the ACLU versus Reno case, Eric?
Yeah, right, the Supreme Court case from 1997.
Right. That, well, no, they're more like the newspapers. They're more like regular media. I believe in that case, Justice Stevens said, well, all media, each medium is, of communication is different, but this one is more like the print media and less like television and radio, which are sort of treated differently because you have to have government licenses. And pretty much said, you know, you can, you, on if you're a site like Google, you can, in effect, edit your content. So that's kind of where we are. I think what we're left with, the interesting part of this is sort of the normative question. As I tell my students, whenever you look at areas like the First Amendment and what the Supreme Court does in it, you sort of have to be a legal realist. The precedents seem to suggest that realistically, sites like Google and YouTube and all the rest of them, Facebook, pretty much would have the same kind of editorial freedom that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution or the New York Times or the Washington Post or any other print medium would have, which would mean pretty much that they can, quote, censor, unquote, or otherwise, or put it in a more benign way, they could edit the content that's on their sites if they want to. And on the other hand, while the precedents seem to go that way, as I tell my students, in the area of constitutional law, it's always a good idea to follow Justice Holmes' claim that the life of the law isn't logic always. It's sometimes it's experience and the felt necessities of the time can produce some interesting results. So that sort of slides us to the normative question, which is, should there be, and I think this is sort of the nub of the matter as a policy matter question, is should there be any kind of limits on the ability of a Facebook or a Twitter or a YouTube or any of these sites to, in effect, edit the content, just like a newspaper editor was? Or do they have some sort of obligation to be almost like a common carrier, the way some of the equal time and right of reply provisions that we've had in the broadcast media have? And I know, I'm doing quite a monologue here. let's hear what you think about this.
Thank you. That was actually a wonderful setup. And I'm just going to pick off a couple of points and then I'll turn it back to you. So from my perspective, so much of the discussion turns on the analogy. What are the major internet companies, especially those that might be described as platforms? Are they technology providers or are they media companies? And to me, the question gets clouded a lot because the companies themselves talk out of both sides of their mouths. Sometimes they'll say they're media companies. Sometimes they'll say they're technology providers. To me, there's really no debate about it. They are media companies, just like the traditional editorial publishers of days of yore. And they exercise their editorial discretion about what content they're going to allow on their network, just like the newspaper decides which stories it's going to cover and how much space to allocate them and what order to put them in, how, you know, which ones go on the front page and which ones go on the back page. if we accept that internet companies are media companies, if we can reach that conclusion, the legal conclusions start to follow to fall into place really quickly. At that point, the First Amendment protects the freedom of speech and freedom of press of media companies. And as Professor Arthur mentioned, there's a long list of ways in which people have tried to make incursions into the discretion of media companies. And for the most part, those fail. And so if we accept internet companies or media companies, they're going to be protected by the same package of rights that we've seen traditionally. We talked a little bit about Section 230, and it's such an important part of the discussion because of its power and breadth. But it is counterintuitive. The way that so many of us learned law in the first year of law school is that if you have some control, you accept liability for what you control. And if you had no control, then you might have reduced liability. And Section 230 says something different. It says you can have absolute editorial control, and you can still not be liable for the things that you exercise editorial control over. And that just blows people's mind. How could that be? But if we think about Section 230 as an extension of the First Amendment, it's a supplement to the First Amendment. It's Congress's way of saying there's certain categories of speech that we value so highly, that we want to encourage, that we're going to go beyond what the First Amendment requires us to protect, and we're going to protect more space than that. And if you think about Section 230 as a speech-enhancing law that sits on top of the First Amendment, it shows you that there may be – it takes us to that normative question, is that a good thing or not? And I'm happy to explain why I think it's a good thing. But really that shifts the ground to the normative question, not the legal question. The legal question is Congress has spoken and it's gone beyond what the First Amendment requires. Section 230 is also a really interesting law because it actually acts as a way of spurring competition among internet companies. It keeps the door open for the next Facebook or the next Google or the next Twitter. Otherwise, without Section 230, anyone who wanted to enter the market would have to build a very expensive infrastructure to make sure that any liability risks were properly managed up front. They'd have to build a team of people who are out there making the kind of editorial judgments that traditional media providers have to make. And that would raise their costs, or they would face crippling liability that the big companies can insure against and can smooth out the averages across a large base, but the small companies can't accept that kind of risk. So Section 230, by allowing sites to exercise the editorial discretion that they want, not make the investments up front that the big companies are making, actually keeps the door open for new emerging companies. And for those who say, well, there's really only three or four providers in the internet space and they're the giants and everyone else doesn't matter, think about the companies that have emerged in just the last few years. Companies like Snapchat or Pinterest have come, I don't want to say out of nowhere, but they've come really fast and quickly in just the last few years. And Section 230 is a big part of that story. The last thing I want to say in my opening remarks here is that we want internet companies to clean up content. We have seen already over and over again in our experience with the internet that any site that isn't actively managing its content will be overrun by the gamers, by the fraudsters, by garbage. There was a reference a decade ago to the idea that there were these cyber cesspools, these places on the internet that were so filled with garbage that there really was no redeeming value to them. The way to avoid those kinds of outcomes, to keep the gamers, the fraudsters, and just the junk from overwhelming tools that we want to be valuable, is for sites to exercise their editorial discretion. And so that actually is a feature of Section 230. It creates the space for sites to exercise that editorial discretion, to keep their sites from turning into garbage without facing liability for whatever they miss, or without facing liability for the judgment calls that other people might disagree with. And so Section 230 is actually a very brilliant solution to the problem of how do we get internet companies to do the work that we want them to do. We give them the incentive, not the obligation, to do that, because they know if they don't exercise that discretion, then they'll become worthless if they become overrun. And if you look at the Chuck Johnson lawsuit, for example, Twitter's position appears to be they terminated him because he was a repeated troll that was reducing the level of discourse on Twitter in a way that was harming Twitter's interests and the interests of Twitter's users. And we want a site like Twitter to be able to shut down the trolls that might be taken away from the rest of everyone else's conversations. Let me take a break there. I'm sure I have more to say, but I'll turn it back to you, Professor Arthur.
Yeah. Yeah, let me, just as Eric has, let me add, just as Eric has added a few additions to what I have to say, I'll add a couple to what he has to say, and that is this. I think what we've got going on here is there has been loose language by companies like Google that, well, look, basically we just want to have a forum, and we're not interested in editing. But the fact of the matter is they can't help but edit. And so, it's true, and I think along with their rhetoric, they don't edit in the way a newspaper does. Like in the famous Miami Herald case that I mentioned earlier versus Tornillo, which pretty much did the end to the Barron and Dean's theory that newspapers should be required to give rights of reply in equal time the way broadcast media had. That case emphasized in its main opinion that, well, the essence of editors is that they edit. And while it's true that the language that we've had, particularly a little bit earlier in the days of the Internet by people like Facebook and Google and so forth, that they didn't want to edit, they weren't there to edit. As Eric points out, you got to edit. Because if you really want to come back and say there's no editing at all, that they're just like a common carrier for anybody who wants to, you can have, as you say, the spam. Not just the objectionable content, and everybody has, as I tell my First Amendment students, everybody has something they would censor. Even the most pro First Amendment, and I'm pretty rigid on that. I'm pretty pro First Amendment. There are some things I wouldn't allow be printed. The case for me was the guy that wanted to publish how to make an atomic bomb in a newspaper. I'm ready to censor that. Everybody has something. So the idea that you could absolutely not edit at all, it's true that sites like Facebook don't edit in the same way we see a newspaper edit that was mentioned in the Miami Herald case. But I think, as Eric points out, they do have to edit somewhat. This is the reality. Some of this other talk might have just been happy talk. They didn't really mean when they sort of said, we're just here to let people talk to each other. Some of it may have just been naive. Maybe it was sincere, but people hadn't really thought it through. But as they've had to think it through, they found that they have to do some editing. And the fact that they don't edit as much as a newspaper or TV or radio station doesn't mean they're not editing. Editing is not a binary, you either do it or you don't do it. It's more of a spectrum. It's more of a matter of degree. The fact that they may not choose not to edit as much as a newspaper doesn't mean that they don't have to edit somewhat. And I think edit, moderate, use whatever word you want, as Eric has pointed out. If you don't want to be overwhelmed by spam or by misleading ads or by child pornography, a whole array of things that I think almost the most libertarian people, and in the First Amendment area, I'm one of the most libertarian people, there's some things that even I would say, no, you can't do that. And I think they just have to do that. That's the normative question. Do we really want to come back and say that they've got to just let anything go and be completely unedited? And I think, I'm not sure that's realistic.
If I can add to that, I think the acid test example for the conservatives who feel like it's a drag that they're being targeted, recognize that the same sites are under extraordinary pressure to try and clean up terrorist and extremist content, whatever that means. And much of that content is unquestionably protected by the First Amendment. So we kind of have to decide, do we want the platforms, which I'm calling media companies, to clean up terrorist and extremist content despite its First Amendment protection? And if so, we already have made a bunch of normative biases about the idea that First Amendment protected content should still not be published by these platforms. And once we go down that line, we kind of have to let the platforms have the discretion then to decide where they're going to draw the lines about First Amendment protected content. Or if we take away their ability to do so, if we remove the discretion of the platforms to decide what content will be on their platforms, then the First Amendment protected terrorist and extremist content is going to stay online as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I also think, to maybe put this also in a little bit more context, despite the claims in some of these lawsuits, it's not true. I mean, it's not a fact that that companies, the plaintiffs like Gab and PragerU, in any event, have been even kept off the sites that they're complaining about. PragerU's educational videos still were on. Admittedly, were on YouTube. The claim was that YouTube only had its a filter for restricted content for under 18-year-olds to watch. And so they weren't being absolutely censored. They could still reach a wide audience. And in the Gab case, Gab itself was a site. And so if you, and I did this as a little experiment, I went to Google and I Googled Gab and I found Gab's website. Now, I don't have an Android phone, so I don't know if there's a Google app, but it wasn't like they're being completely restricted and censored. A bit of burden for sure, but it hasn't been a thoroughgoing censorship. I mean, even the Chump Johnson case, where he's not on Twitter, Twitter is not the only thing on the web. And it's unclear to me, I mean, an argument that people need to keep in mind is that the fact that you're not able to reach, to sort of be on the platform with the widest viewer point, isn't that different from the fact that you don't automatically have a right to, you know, have your op-ed published in the New York Times or broadcast on CBS. That's not considered to be censorship of the kind that we're talking about, government censorship.
Last thing I might toss in, and I don't know how close we are to audience questions, but I think we're getting pretty close, is that the First Amendment may, and Section 230 definitely applies in circumstances where the defendant has engaged in discriminatory practices. And we have a wide range of examples about that. The case I teach in my internet law class is a case from 2003. It was NOAA versus AOL. And NOAA was an AOL subscriber who alleged that AOL discriminated against him in various chat rooms on the basis of the fact, I'm sorry, discriminated against Muslims, including him, in AOL chat rooms, and the way that they moderated content and treated various individuals. They let a bunch of anti-Muslim remarks be shared in these chat rooms that were offensive to Muslims, and then allegedly they took retaliation effort against Muslims who complained. And so he brought a very standard anti-discrimination claim, saying AOL has discriminated against me on the basis of my race and my religion. And Section 230 said, we don't care. That is their discretion. If you're trying to hold AOL liable for the content of third parties, in this case, these people are saying really stupid things in the chat room, Section 230 applies. You lose. And so Political affiliation in the media context actually isn't a protected class at all. But even if it were, Section 230 still applies. And so it really gets down to the power of Section 230 and the vision that we aren't going to hold the intermediaries liable for the third-party content that they publish. And that if they feel the need to remove content, similarly, we're not going to hold them liable for how they choose to remove content. That's their discretion. We want them to exercise that discretion because in the end, we're going to get a bunch of net social goods, a bunch of work that has social value because of the fact that they're cleaning up the spammers and the gamers and the trolls.
Yeah. And let me say one last thing, and let me take off my First Amendment professor hat and put back on my antitrust professor hat. One of the things that Section 230 does, and this is looking at it from an industrial organization / antitrust perspective, is that it removes a barrier to entry. Just as Eric said, the fact that small new sites are not in as good a position to defend themselves against liability, to protect themselves against liability like the big boys are, 230 gives them a sort of protection. I don't want to call it a subsidy exactly, but you know they don't have to worry about liability. In the way. So for a Gab, for example, well, 230 might be a problem for it in its attempts to have an antitrust suit against Google. But Section 230 also makes Gab itself free from liability for the third-party content that it wants to post or that's posted on its site. And that certainly cuts down its cost of business. Are we ready for questions?
I am.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question.
Hello, this is Gary Wheaton again in New Hampshire. I'm going to short, quick comment here, and then if you can kind of answer it somehow. There seems to be that what we need is some kind of, I don't know if it's bright line rules, but we need some kind of rules because, I mean, you really are talking about antitrust here. If it's, you know, obviously if it's a private entity, the First Amendment won't apply. But unless the government is encouraging those private entities to, you know, censor content, of course, we all understand that. So if you've got, let's be real. I mean, Google, Facebook, all these things, these really are monopolies. So, you know, we can argue that, of course, arguably. But when you have monopoly situations, then the government can just say, you know, you've got to let the content go. Now, you guys are real good at saying there's garbage and this and that and the other thing, but what is garbage, right? So one man's garbage is another man's treasure. So obviously, again, these things are obvious rules. Political speech can't be censored. I mean, it's free speech. Now, is it garbage? Well, you know, obviously Prager University is not garbage. Now, you say that's only an age restriction because 18 years old or whatever. Let's be real again. They're censoring it. There's no age. There's no pornography in Prager University's product. So how can you logically say it's an age problem? You can say the content is adult, but how is that adult when it's political speech? You know, I mean, our teachers arguably are liberal, and they indoctrinate young people less than 18. So why can't Prager University indoctrinate less than 18? I mean, this is what we're talking about here. So let's cut to the chase. And so the question would be, what kind of rules would you have then? You know, I mean, you guys are the experts. You use the term garbage. What is garbage? Yeah, obviously, we can use some of those First Amendment things like imminent danger, imminent, you know, harm is really where the line is for me. If it's harming somebody, let's use that as a starting point for the rule. But if not, what rules would you guys propose, I guess is my question.
Professor Arthur, I have some comments, but I don't know if you want to go first.
Not necessary. You go ahead, Eric, and I'll chime in.
Yeah, let's start with the antitrust issue, and I think that the Tornillo Miami Herald case is actually quite helpful here, because as Professor Arthur pointed out, at the time in the mid 70s, there was one newspaper in a metro area in virtually all the major metro areas. There was no question that the newspaper was a monopoly in its local market. And the court still said that the newspaper had the absolute right to deny access to somebody who wanted to espouse their political views. So as a matter of First Amendment law, I think if we accept that internet companies are media companies, the monopolist label doesn't really change the discussion at all. It actually reinforces the fact that even in that circumstance, they have their discretion. The phrase that YouTube is censoring Prager University, I would just point out, as we know, that censorship can only be done by the government or a state actor. Everything else is something else. And when we're talking about media companies, what someone might call censorship is the media company exercising its editorial discretion. It's deciding what's fit for its audience or not. That might be colloquially described as censorship, and I understand that you know, if you don't know the difference between a state actor and a private actor, it all looks the same. But the label censorship here, every time you hear that in the discussion of a media company, what you're really saying is they're exercising their editorial discretion. And when we phrase it that way, we realize, actually, we want them to do that. That's what media companies do. That's why they're valuable, is because they have that kind of judgment. The last thing is this question about what is garbage. I don't actually think we need to answer that, because it ends up being an irrelevant question. Once we phrase the issue as media companies exercising editorial discretion, they'll define what's garbage by their own definition. And if what they define as garbage is something that we would have thought is the most valuable content, well, they're underserving us as an audience. That's going to be a problem in the marketplace. But ultimately, in the end, we have to defer to their editorial discretion. They decide what they think is relevant to their audience. That we don't get to tell them that they made the wrong call.
Now, that's pretty much my view too. I mean, but let me just add to that. Let me do the antitrust side of this. I think Eric expressed pretty much the First Amendment side, which is, if I could say it in a nutshell, if they have the ability to edit, they have the ability to edit. And I would agree with you, with the caller, that the PragerU videos don't seem to me to be inappropriate for folks under 18. But that's just a disagreement that I would have with the editorial decision that YouTube has made, assuming they actually are making it. That's what's alleged in the complaint. But I also disagree with what the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is my local newspaper, has on some of the stuff they put on their pages. And it's the nature of First Amendment issues that you can edit, you know, you can say good things and you can say bad things. You can edit in a good way or you can edit in a bad way, but it's sort of like it's a compared to what question. Is the media company a better a safer editor of its content in the sort of the marketplace of media, or is the government? And history shows that the government is not really someone you should trust to edit, and it's hard to come up with an alternative. Putting my antitrust hat on like I said I was going to do and actually getting to it, antitrust doesn't automatically create a utility type of regulation. If there are antitrust cases against people like Google, YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, ultimately the remedy is to break them up. And it's not necessarily to make them into utilities. That antitrust law is not a cure for whatever ails you, despite a lot of loose language about it. Antitrust is not something that it turns a company into a utility. In fact, my antitrust professor view is that's a terrible thing to do. You're a lot better if it turns out that their people are unhappy with what they see on a Facebook or a Google or whatever. That creates the market opportunity for somebody to provide an alternative. Personally, I hate the way Google has moved in recent years to have these wretched ads at the beginning of all of the searches I do. I much preferred it before they had that, and if another search engine will come up that gives me what I used to get from Google, I'll switch to it. And I can switch very, very easily. So antitrust-wise, I really don't see antitrust as providing this sort of public utility type of provision that people seem to think it will.
And Professor Arthur, if I can add just one more thing, I just want to come back to the theme of the question and all the different ways that perhaps Chuck Johnson is getting screwed or Prager University is getting screwed. Put change plaintiffs here. ISIS sues Twitter or YouTube or Facebook for removing its First Amendment-protected terrorist-promoting videos. And they make the same antitrust claims, and they claim that the sites are making improper editorial judgments about what's garbage or not. If Chuck Johnson's theories prevail, so does ISIS's.
And I think just to underline that, if this seems fanciful, what Eric is saying, the number one case in whether the First Amendment protects speech by extremist groups is Brandenburg versus Ohio, which was a case involving the Ku Klux Klan. And the court held that what they were doing was protected so long as it didn't actively incite imminent violence and there was an actual threat of imminent violence. That's a very protective standard. And the fact that I don't want, you know, I agree with that opinion as far as the government's concerned, but I don't think that would mean that TV stations and newspapers should have to carry the Klan's ads if they don't want to. And I hope they don't want to, quite honestly.
Are we ready for another question?
I think we are, yeah.
Great. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Gene Berg. Good afternoon. My question about a perhaps not an antitrust approach, but more a contractual approach to this issue. Of course, each website, including Google or Facebook or what's not, they have terms and conditions which constituted a contract, a commercial contract. And the Prager University, other providers, they are commercial parties to this contract. Can you see that they would have a obligation, they meaning the Google, they would have to obligation to enforce the contract in a fair and equitable fashion because it's part of the good faith requirement of the contract. If sites like Prager University, they invested money, they invested funds into the developing their content and they give this content in reliance on this expectation of fair and equitable enforcement, wouldn't that be unfair to single them out comparing to the providers that give, for example, left-wing content?
Professor Arthur, I do want to chime in on this one.
Go ahead.
If you don't mind. Absolutely. A contract could be a basis in which a person whose content was removed could seek redress, except that the contracts are never going to say anything that provides support for those claims. In fact, almost all the relevant contracts are going to say things like, we can remove your content at any time in our discretion. And they're going to say things like, you should not rely upon the availability of our service. And they're going to say things like, we limit our damages to the amount that you paid us, and so on and so forth. So the contract arguments really don't advance the ball very much because the contracts themselves are going to be too thin a foundation to rely upon.
And if they aren't already, they sure as hell will be once the Google's lawyers get a hold of them.
No, they are already. And I will add that there's the possibility that Section 230 would protect the defendants, even in the case of a contract claim, for exercising their discretion. As we said, Section 230 says that a site is not liable for its decision to remove content. And there's an unclear interplay between a contract promise on the one hand and then Section 230 that says you can remove content without liability. So even if the contract works, there still could be a Section 230 defense, but the contract isn't going to work.
We have two more callers in line, so let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, so I have a quick question regarding beyond the current law right now. Do you think that constitutionally, if Congress, you know, got together, maybe there's a bipartisan effort to either limit or to, you know, even change the rules in regards to maybe, for example, making Google and various companies a common carrier, or to saying, you know, for example, you can't use your editorial discretion for political views, or you can't favor, I know for some of the antitrust arguments, you can't favor your types of businesses, like say a Gmail versus other email providers on your search engine part. Do you think that those sorts of statutes would be able to stand under constitutional, review?
Well, I think with regard to the competition law, as I said before, it's not clear that antitrust law would prohibit favoring your own content, for example. But certainly Congress could pass a law that would impose some kind of common carrier obligations if they wanted to, for things that don't raise First Amendment issues. I mean, they can antitrust law is almost always made by the courts, but as I tell my antitrust classes, there's nothing that says that Congress, if they're not happy with the way the courts are interpreting the antitrust law, can't modify it. They haven't on the substantive side literally since 1950 in the Merger Act, but they could. But as a First Amendment issue, I think that's a tougher issue. If we are correct, Eric and I think are pretty much on the same page about this, if we are correct that these are properly classified as media companies, the First Amendment is, as it's been interpreted for a long, long time, and again, the Miami Herald case is probably the leading case, makes it kind of tough for the Congress to come back and impose these kinds of rules about what you can and can't have on your sites.
I agree with that. I would point to the Reno versus ACLU decision in 1997 that did say that there was no basis for Congress to qualify the level of protection that is applied to the internet. And so Congress can't just make up that internet companies have become common carriers. They're going to be subject to the full level of First Amendment scrutiny for doing so. I think the idea about the self-favoritism and how that creates antitrust issues is a more complicated one. There has been a lot of questions about the self-promotion of other services. I see that as a different issue. I don't think it really responds to the thing that brought us to this call about whether they're discriminating against conservative viewpoints or not. So I would put that in a separate bucket, and that I see as a more complicated question.
It looks like we have one final question. Let's go to this caller.
Hello, my name is Nellie. I'm from Chicago, and I have the following question. Today, we were mostly considering this discussion from the perspective of freedom of speech violations, but I feel that there is another point of view that's neglected usually when people talk about freedom of speech on social media, and it's particularly violation of consumer rights. And most precisely, misleading advertisements, in the sense that all these social media services advertise themselves as forums, while in fact what happens is that they actually act as media venues, and their content is curated. It's not random. It's curated content that's carefully filtered, and in this respect, they're actually misleading consumers to believe that they're there to read randomly produced free information when this isn't the case. And I would like to hear your perspective on that. And particularly, I would like to bring your attention to the case when in 2014, Facebook actually conducted experiments with its consumers by actually manipulating the timelines on their profiles by only publishing content just to experiment with their emotions and their reactions. Do you believe that it would make more sense to approach that issue from simply consumer standpoint?
I know we're running out of time. Let me just make a couple of remarks. First of all, I think it is helpful to ask the question from the consumer perspective. But when we talk about that, we are talking consumers of media products. And so we start with the premise that the providers of those media services have such enormous discretion. The consumers then have the choice, do I read or not read? And should I invest my media dollars in reading this product or some other product? So the consumer issues are all framed by the fact that there's such great discretion on the part of the media providers. But your broader point, I think, is that if the companies engage in false advertising, there can be a claim for false advertising that might be independent of all the other considerations that we discussed. And even Section 230 might not protect against false advertising. If a company describes itself as having a particular type of service, and even if they're a service that publishes third-party content, if they've misdescribed what they're doing, then that is their own words that they should be held accountable for. We've had some very confusing case law about the interplay between Section 230 and the first and the false advertising claims, and so I won't say that Section 230 is irrelevant to that discussion. But no doubt that if we can find an example where a company is engaged in false advertising, that should be evaluated on its own terms.
Yeah. And the only thing I would add from the First Amendment standpoint, the Supreme Court's made it very clear that commercial speech, which includes advertising, any speech for money, isn't protected as much as other types of speech, and in particular, deceptive claims or misleading claims are not protected by the First Amendment. So to the extent that they're holding themselves to doing A and in fact do non-A, then that's a very different matter.
The only thing I'll add is that though the false advertising claims may escape some of the First Amendment and Section 230 restrictions, they're also going to be tough to win in many cases. In many cases, the companies aren't engaged in false advertising when you run through the legal elements, or there may be standing issues or other limits on the ability to bring those claims. So I don't think they're a panacea, but I do think that they raise a different set of questions than the bulk of our conversation today.
And I guess the last word I would have on that, if assuming that they are, then the question is, what would the remedy be? And typically the remedy for something like this is disclosure, maybe a more frank disclosure of exactly what they're doing. And, of course, that disclosure, unfortunately, is probably going to be buried somewhere in the terms of service that we all click on automatically and don't read.
Would either of you like to make some final remarks?
Actually, I would, and I'll keep them brief. First of all, thank you for convening this forum. Thank you to all those who are listening and participating in this call. I'm glad we're having this discussion. I will say that from my perspective, I've been intrigued by how many, quote, conservatives, and I use that in quotes only because I don't really know what that word means, are looking for ways to increase the regulation of the media industry. And from the libertarian or quasi-libertarian perspective, it just makes me scratch my head. what do we really want to go there? And at the end of this process, if all these arguments work, are we going to be better off because there's going to be swings in who's in the powers, the corridors of power, and there's going to be swings in prevailing social norms. But if we built a regulatory infrastructure to restrict the discretion of internet companies to what they can do so that more people can tell them what to do, are we going to get what we want at the end of the day on that? And I encourage all of you who are chomping at the bit for more successful lawsuits to really think about how is this going to blow up on us when the pendulum shifts?
Yeah, I agree totally with what Eric just said. One of the things I tell my First Amendment class is you've got to understand that this is the kind of thing, the First Amendment doesn't favor liberals or conservatives. It doesn't favor any particular view. It protects all the views. And you might desire to suppress the view you don't disagree with, but if you have that power, then ultimately that means other people will have the power to to stifle your views. And I think history has shown that that's a power when you give it to government. It really isn't healthy. And the United States, with its First Amendment, is the freest country in the world with regard to expression. There are a lot of people pushing back from that. As the late Nat Hentoff of the Village Voice used to say, the freedom of speech and freedom of the press are always under attack from either the left or the right. When I was a child, I still remember some of the earliest things I remember my parents talking about in worried tones was the McCarthyism movement, where freedom of speech, freedom of expression was being threatened from the right. Now I see freedom of speech often, as Mr. Hentoff had said at the time, seems to be threatened more from the left. But it's always going to be threatened by somebody who doesn't like, and left and right tend to be arbitrary categories anyway. There'll be people with a point of view that won't want to have opposite points of view being expressed. And once we let it down so that some of that can be done by the government because we like it for our particular thing, ultimately it can come around and bite you in the rear end and be used against you. I personally believe we're better off not having that power expressed by the government, because I frankly think there's a long history of governments regulating speech, and it's not a happy history. I think that's my last word.
It's a great word to end on.
Thanks to everybody.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. Our next teleforum call is on Monday, January, not 16th, January 23rd, and that will be on the 2017 Mercatus Report, so be sure to tune in for that. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.